restrict it.
In the racketeering.
We should restrict it as severely as possible so that we don't get into some strange situations where it might conceivably be criminal to engage in conduct which should, say, be within the company, as Justice Sloan suggests. That there are some things that should not be criminal and left up to the employers and the companies to deal with.
Well, Connecticut says having control over labor in the employ of another person, or of business, commercial, or industrial equipment or facilities of another person, knowing that he is not entitled to the use thereof, and with intent to derive a commercial benefit for himself or a third person, he uses or diverts to the use of himself or a third person such labor, equipment, or facilities.
Now that's substantially the same as New York.
Yeah. Now, they don't say not entitled there too. Maybe we don't need that. I don't know. But it's cleaner. It's cleaner than the way we amended it. Let me read it again. A person commits theft if having control over labor in the employ of another person, or of business, commercial, or industrial equipment or facilities of another person, knowing that he is not entitled to the use thereof, and with intent to derive a commercial benefit for himself or a third person, he uses or diverts to the use of himself or a third person such labor, equipment, or facilities.
That's practically the way you
answer. We're back to go on
full circle here.
Well, what would you think of this? Now, of course, this doesn't expand it. This limits it. But what would you think of language to limit the application of this section to defendants who were in the employ of another person? In other words, language such as while in the employ of another person and in such capacities having control over labor or of business or of such person's business, commercial, or industrial equipment or facilities. All it does is it restricts it.
Yeah. And makes other elements that the state would have to prove.
Yeah, you have to prove that he was in the employ of another person at the time he did this. But it seems to me that that's what we're trying to get at.
Well, aren't you also aiming at the... I would have a hunch that the people that they were aiming at, in, for instance, in New York, would be more likely to be hiring all people.
Well, that isn't what their commentary says. Now, they may have had this in mind also, Justice Sloan, but their commentary to their Section 7 states that this offense is included for the purpose of plugging an apparent gap in the present law pointed out by the decision of People versus Ashworth. The defendants therein, a mill superintendent and his brother, were convicted of grand larceny as a result of having made unauthorized and personally profitable use of the mill's machinery, facilities, and labor to spin a substantial quantity of wool for a certain company. The judgment was reversed on the ground that the corrupt use of the mill's facilities and labor did not constitute a theft of property, quote unquote, and hence could not be the subject of larceny. This subdivision herein renders such conduct a theft of services.
Can't you see the... I think this is a common thing, though, in labor racketeering. Well, not common, but I think it's a very good possibility. And so I don't see anything wrong with just leaving it the way it is.
Yeah, well,
this takes in the person outside the employee.
I mean, since my time, I knew of a situation in Portland, or at least alleged to have been this way, that an officer of a corporation that had control of the facilities, of the contract facilities and equipment and labor, engaged in the practice of buying old dilapidated houses and then somehow getting those houses all fixed up, and he would buy the houses firstly and then sell them firstly at a big, big profit. And he would do that one house after the other, and for several years he did, and get himself rich. And I don't know whether he was an employee of anybody or not, he was an officer of the corporation where he had some influence.
And he used the facilities.
Used the facilities and labor. Building those, I mean, repairing those houses on the side. And this would get at that kind of thing.
I think it's limited enough the way it is, in my opinion.
You mean it would get at it if we didn't?
Yeah, if we didn't limit it too much.
In the employee,
Yeah, I just can't see how it helps him. And he can make the defendant be working for somebody for wages. It is the labor of another person we're talking about, and this way we have that labor here, it looks like control over how he does his work. Labor in the sense of a commodity is what we're talking about.
Well,
do you have any other observations, Don?
No.
Do you, Justice Long?
No.
How about you, Ed?
Well, the only thing I can tell you is that I'm leading toward expanding it, not narrowing it. Somebody is in effect stealing labor from someone. I think that's just about as serious a theft as you can find.
We got involved in this discussion over the question whether we should use the word A or the word such. Now I know why our Supreme Court sometimes writes long opinions. But
well, if it's any consolation, some of the preliminary drafts that were ultimately discarded appear as preliminary drafts number 11 of the Model Penal Code. So you can see that we're not alone with this.
Well, I was going to...
That's that bigger committee.
I was going to paraphrase Justice Rossman and say, if an absurdity exists in this language, it exists with the legislature and not with the court. But here's the way we were before we got hung up. We were going to say a person commits theft if having control over the disposition of labor or business, commercial, or industrial equipment or facilities of another to which he is not entitled, and with intent to derive a commercial benefit for himself or a third person not entitled thereto. And then down to there, I think we all pretty much agreed. And then he uses, and I'm going to suggest from there on, he said, he uses or diverts such labor, equipment, or facilities to the use of himself or a third person. There we are again. Or to such third person. Now we were going to go up or such.
No, I don't think it's such.
No, I don't think so either. I think it's a derivation of commercial benefit to somebody that's not entitled to it, arising out of the use of the equipment. I don't think we need those qualifying words.
I don't think so either.
All right. So,
actually, what we're saying, he diverts it to where it doesn't belong.
Right. He uses or diverts to the use of himself or a third person such labor, equipment, or facilities, period.
Yeah, it is again.
All right. Having control over the disposition of labor of another. No, wait. Having control over the disposition of labor or of business, commercial, or industrial equipment or facilities of another to which he is not entitled. And with intent to derive a commercial benefit for himself or a third person not entitled thereto, he uses or diverts to the use of himself or a third person such labor, equipment, or facilities.
The only thing I did a while ago when I was talking too fast was mix those ideas up in a little bit different rotation.
Can we have a second not entitled there too?
Here's what I said a while ago,
and I couldn't follow you.
And I'm not sure that it was in any benefit, but I'll try it again. A person commits theft if, having control over the disposition of labor or business, commercial, or industrial equipment or facilities of another, he uses or diverts to the use of himself or a third person such labor, equipment, or facilities with the intent to derive a commercial benefit for himself or a third person not entitled thereto. Get the same function, but a little bit different order. And it puts the intent on the end of it, which is the point we're getting at.
Did you say he uses or diverts to the use of himself or a third person
such labor, equipment, or facilities with intent to derive a commercial benefit for himself or a third person not entitled thereto?
I think that's better. Can you
read it back?
I think I've got it. Go ahead.
But the way it was, we kind of pile up things before we say what we're talking about.
A person commits theft if, having control over the disposition of labor or of business, commercial, or industrial equipment or facilities of another, he uses or diverts to the use of
himself
or
a third person.
Such labor, equipment, or facilities with intent to derive a commercial benefit for himself or a third person not entitled thereto.
Yeah.
That sounds right to me. I don't know if it's technically correct or not, but it sure sounds.
At least at this stage, recognizing the merit and reason behind the use of the term in the employ, and the other codes, we're not going to restrict ours to that, and we're going to go this way. Now, I think all in favor section 2B as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Now,
John, before we go on, I mentioned that Jane Gerhardt just came out. I think everyone is acquainted with Mrs. Gerhardt. I talked to her last Friday and suggested that Kathleen was going to be gone this week, if she had time to drop in, we'd be glad to have the benefit of her expert observations in our meeting. Although this is an informal on her part, and she may not be able to stay very long. But.
Okay. Glad to have you here, Jane, and feel this is informal, and feel free to raise any questions that you wish as we go along. We now completed one and two, and the next decision that we have to make is whether we're going to go to the language in the present Oregon Friday Innkeeper Statute, which spells out the, with some specificity, the manner in which a prima facie case can be, or you can give rise to a prima facie case, or whether we're going to use the broad general language that we looked over last time. Now, Ed, you made the observation when Don was reading this that you thought that that we were better advised to stick with the language of the current statute and shove it in as sub-3.
Right, here's how I feel about it. Either adopt this language of the town president statute or else go the rollout of the New York code. And I've been reading the New York code in its entirety, but it's fine to me. But I could be easily fooled on it, but to me, it seems necessary. This business of this absconding over here, and that's the only test, I think if the judge leaves the thing viable, I don't think you have the innkeeper statute anymore at all, really. And I'm basing this entirely on what Kathleen Bouvet said last time. I agree with her completely. You just use the word absconding as a test, oh boy. You have no prime basis at all.
Here, what you're saying is, if you just forget to pay
and
you leave,
yeah.
You might get an instruction that that constitutes absconding.
Yeah.
You'd
have a tough time getting such an instruction, wouldn't you? A real tough time.
Well, I would think so.
Yeah, I would hope so.
I don't think you'd ever find a judge in the world.
I don't think so.
Well, you just have to have an issue of class of whether you forgot to pay or not.
Well, I think that these other tests have been developed over a long period of time for good reason.
What do you think?
From some very solid reasons, and I don't think they're in there just for privileges, so I'd like to stick to those unless someone can point out to me where it wouldn't be right to have them there.
What do you think, Bruce?
I use them. We should have it here. A person who fails or refuses to pay for such services is presumed to have intended to avoid payment.
All right, what do you think?
And that's B.
On demand, it says.
That's where I would read.
Oh, well, on B, 3B, it says, person refused or neglected to pay for such food, lodging, or other accommodation on demand. That means the innkeeper met him at the door and said, here, it's time to pay now. So I'll say, no, I'm not going to pay for this. Then he has a reason to start acting, you see. There's a point at which he should be able to.
Let me say,
which one are you looking at, Herb?
2A.
2A, yeah.
Under
3,
subsection 3B.
Let me interject the minutes from the last meeting. I think it'd be helpful. The committee discussed the meaning of absconding, and Mr. Paulette indicated that it meant more than not paying for a service. It also included a right of way. He noted that 165.630D stated that one instance of prima facie evidence of fraudulent intent was when a person absconded without paying or offering to pay for such food. Now, that was, that's where in draft 2A. Oh, that's D over here on page 2 of preliminary draft 2A.
Yes.
All right. And added that the prima facie provisions in the proposed draft were not as broad as those contained in the present Oregon law. He pointed out that subsection 3 of the draft didn't go as far as either the New York or Model Penal Code sections where refusal to pay was prima facie evidence of deception, whereas the proposed draft would make it prima facie fraudulent only if the actor absconded without payment or offered to pay. Mr. Follett explained that subsection 3 was intended to be limited to the type of service received in a hotel or restaurant where service was ordinarily paid for immediately upon the rendering of it. It was not intended to apply to the man who absconded without paying his gas or electric bill, because that type of service was ordinarily paid for on a monthly basis, and that type of act wouldn't raise a prima facie case. Now, Ms. Buffet noted that if a person openly walked out the front door without paying his bill, he wouldn't be absconding. But if he left by way of the back window, his act would come under subsection 3. She asked if one reason for using this type of language was to protect from civil liability the proprietor who ran out and seized the man who hadn't paid his bill, just as protection from liability was built into the shoplifting statute, etc., etc. Mr. Paulette replied that he didn't believe that this was a principal reason. Other states adopted similar language, but it nevertheless would protect the proprietor by providing probable cause for arrest. Now, and then we have some more discussion, and as a matter of fact, we have another page and a half of discussion. But, what your intent was, Don, was that this wouldn't be as broad really as present Oregon law.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I purposely did it that way. Well, for one thing, it seems to be the direction that not only the Model Penal Code takes, but all these other code revisions, limited to this type of situation. And I wonder if this type of conduct presents enough of a social problem to warrant such a extensive listing of things that will amount to prima facie evidence of a criminal intent. Seems to me that there's a good reason for having protection for the individual, or for the proprietor, against an individual who absconds, who runs off with the intent not to pay for the services. But when you're talking about some of these other acts, for example, a person might refuse to pay for the food he obtained on demand because he didn't like the nature of the service, or he didn't like the kind of food he got. He thought it was a rotten meal, and he says, I'm not going to pay you for your food. Now, should that raise a prima facie case that he went into the restaurant with the intent to defraud the innkeeper? I don't personally think it should, but...
And you get all these... list of things that are prima facie evidence, and the defendant might be able to turn that around and convince the jury that that's what they got to prove one of those.
And is there really, yes, and is there really a problem with the individual who's still on the premises, or who's still around? Aren't there other remedies available to the proprietor?
I suppose one of the hotel keeper's problems is that every time a guest goes in or out the door, he doesn't know whether he's coming back or not. And he can't stop him every time he goes out the door and ask him for his dough.
I think, though, that the law may be going one way, but the practice may be going the other, actually. I think there are more people, more scoffing at the law and paying necessity to pay bills, that sort of thing. I think before we make a solid decision on this, we really should, kind of sample the field and see whether we're being practical.
What do you mean, sir?
Well, I think we should hear some people who, I think we should hear some innkeepers, I think we should hear some people who have this problem and see if they think that we're unduly concerned about it or not concerned enough or what, really.
Well, and we'll, after we make our recommendation to the full committee and after it has acted or tentatively approved it, then we'll before a final decision is given to it, we'll hear the views of those people, but we have to make a preliminary decision now.
We're not very well armed to do it, I don't think.
We've had some experience with the problem.
Well, of course, any of these drafts that are approved by the subcommittee, and even those that are going to be approved later by the commission are going to be subject to further modification and amendment.
Yeah, we're not passing the law.
I think we ought to either accept this 2A or we should go to 2B. I like 2B. Maybe we make changes in there that would fit into what we have 2A.
Now,
if they've gone to a real comprehensive draft and it covers the same subject and does the same thing as 2A, as far as I can see.
Yeah, 2B, of course, that's patent after the New York Penal Law.
Yeah,
they employ the language, a person who fails or refuses to pay for such services is presumed to have intended to avoid payment, therefore.
Where is that?
That's under subsection 1, the last sentence in subsection 1 of draft.
Yeah, chapter. That's what I was reading a while ago.
A person who fails or refuses to pay for such services is presumed to have intended to avoid payment, therefore.
Yeah, in other words, we even have a thing, it's up to you to prove that you did it by mistake. You got it.
Right. That's pretty similar to absconding, except that absconding connotes stealth, right? And actually, this New York presumption is a little bit tougher. Is a little bit tougher on the.
Oh, that's a little strong. I see what you mean by that.
Yeah, that was what I meant with my language that you quoted from the minutes of the last meeting. That our draft, our preliminary draft number one, did not go as far as the New York draft.
Oh, yeah.
You see, we required that the defendant absconded.
If you fail to pay, then that's prima facie.
I think it's going too far.
All right.
I'll go back to my about 3B and say the person who refuses to make a petition is providing another company on demand.
3B?
Yeah, 3B and preliminary draft 2A.
The person who refuses is directed to pay.
Well, I
don't think the question is whether the food was palatable or not. Was it served, and was there, and did the person ask to have it served to him? That's really the question.
Well,
or even if the charge was reasonable.
He knows what the charge is before he orders it. Mm-hmm. Most restaurants, except for the very finest of restaurants, I suppose, always have the charge listed there, and there's many.
When you go in and get a room, which you think is going to be $20, and they charge you $50 for it, you say, the hell with it. You're guilty of a crime.
We're talking, I don't think that we should lose sight of the fact that the only thing we're really talking about here is a presumption or a prima facie showing. And you can prove, you can, the district attorney can establish his case without the benefit of the statutory presumption if he has a case. And I think what Don is saying in his original draft is that we're saying that a person commits theft if with intent to avoid payment, therefore he obtains some of these different kinds of services by force, threat, deception, or other means. And one of the aids by which the prosecutor, or one of the criteria that the prosecutor has for making determination test is that if you abscond without payment or without an offer to pay, then it's prima facie evidence. Well, that's not to say that if you refuse to pay on demand, that you're still not guilty. The prosecution just isn't afforded the presumption.
Yeah, but the other side of that line is that this is usually a small amount of money involved, and if the hotel keeper has got to get himself in a position where he can get you arrested, you're going to pay $50 for a $10 room before you run through with it. And it's an injustice to people if that occurs. He can beat the case here if he's got a legitimate beef.
Well, I think you're saying the same thing.
No, we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
We're saying the same thing as to what the law means, but as to what's right and wrong, they can be saying it.
No.
Maybe,
no.
Maybe we could change the word absconding in subsection 3 of 2 and change it to absenting himself from the premises or something.
I think you ought to put an element of wrongful conduct before you give me.
Well, that's why we use the word absconding.
Yeah.
Well, and absconding is practically meaningless.
No,
no, it has a definite.
It is.
Well, okay.
And it, but it has a meaning that means a lot more than just leaving without paying.
Yeah.
It implies an intent to
free
yourself.
Let's say what we mean. All right, I'll go along with you, but let's define absconding then so that we know what we mean. Because I'm a little bit alarmed about it. I'm a little bit alarmed about the present use of the word absconding. And so let's say what we mean, Doug.
Well,
if a guy goes into a hotel and waits until he sees that no proprietor of the hotel is looking, and he goes out the front door and doesn't come back, he's absconding.
And never pays the bill.
Yeah.
I'll buy that if we'll put that into the... We'll write that in here, but I don't think that's what the present usage in the law is.
It has an element of wrongful conduct.
If we could say in there something that says that this, you know what I want.
Let's say a bad.
Webster's 7th New Collegiate Dictionary defines abscond as meaning to depart secretly and hide oneself.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not...
Well, we have...
Depart secretly. Let's define abscond. So
and that's what Kathleen meant when she said that if the individual goes out the back window, he would be... There would be a prima facie case against him under that first draft, but if he walked out the front door, there might not be.
Yeah,
well,
but
depending on the circumstances under which he walked out the front door.
Yeah.
Seems to me like that, Ed, you may be raising too much of a bugle about the use of the word abscond. Mm-hmm. But as Bruce said, too, that it has an element of bad conduct about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we want.
And that's what you want.
Yes.
You certainly could not be held for absconding if you're challenging the the rate at which they offer pay. And he said, I registered for $10 rooms. You told me that's what it'd be. Now you want $50. I'll pay you $10. But if he just sneaks out the door when the clerk is looking or leaves without paying, then that may put a different complexion on it.
Now, Ed, what we're saying in 3, or what Don is saying in sub 3, or preliminary draft 2, that language is essentially identical to the language in 3B of preliminary draft 2A. You were correct. You agreed with me.
Yeah, that's only part.
All right.
That's only part of it.
Now, I would think, and would you not agree, that 3E would come within the purview of 3D. If you surreptitiously remove your baggage, that would be an act of absconding.
All right, so those two are covered.
Now, right. Would you also agree that just the refusal or neglect to pay for the food or lodging, as is contained in 3B, shouldn't constitute a prima facie evidence of intent to defraud because of an honest difference of opinion? And if you agree that that shouldn't be covered, we're only arguing about 3A and 3C, both of which aren't embraced in the act of absconding, but both of which are acts of deception and make it possible to prove, and maybe prove, as acts of deception.
Yeah, I would agree that a prosecutor who was going to prosecute under this section would have a pretty good case if he had evidence to show that the person paying for that service with a check that was returned NSF or no account.
And he didn't he'd had
CD 300
NSF checks,
yeah.
50.
CD and DD are, I would think, pretty well covered under abscond.
Now, if you went in to Jane Gearhart's hotel, the Notel, and registered as, I don't know, quiz or why, and by means of a false pretense, ran up a big bill, the prosecutor certainly has sufficient evidence.
Anyone can beat the innkeeper of the law just by raising an argument about the type of service or the value of the service that he received, right?
Not necessarily
beating. He could certainly raise an issue and a question of fact at the time of the trial.
I think he. Well,
but the prosecutor would not have the benefit of a prima facie case from the fact that he didn't pay in of itself. But if the evidence was that he was unreasonable and he tried to say that he was supposed to get room for a dollar, we have to the jury to believe or not, but he just wouldn't have a prima facie case without proof of some wrongful conduct.
So you're not intending to provide what may be a civil remedy for this. It's a criminal charge.
Right.
And if I were to go to the Hilton Hotel and run up a $300 bill and then get in a beef with them over the thing, and it's a legitimate beef one way or another, they can sue me for. This kind of thing, you're not going to catch this kind of conduct or this kind of activity with a criminal statute. What they're after is the guy that goes in and runs up a $300 bill under the guise that he's there campaigning for Robert Kennedy, and Kennedy's going to pay the bill. And he walks out without paying for it. That's the guy they're after. They're not the fellow who has some kind of a beef about his bill. They can settle that civilly. You don't have to try and prosecute a criminal.
But he can avoid the innkeeper statute. So if you take out CB, he can avoid the criminal penalties by just saying, well, I just don't agree with, and the innkeeper has no prima facie case, and he has no immunity if he makes an arrest. We're not talking about the...
Well, maybe he's not entitled to an arrest if there's a legitimate deed.
My thought last week, when I suggested to Don that we put in the various sections from the Oregon Code, was that we were unduly restricting it, as it appears in preliminary draft 2. But looking at this and analyzing it, analyzing draft 2 with 2A, I believe that sub 3 is sufficient. I think we've reached an impasse. I think we ought to take a vote. I believe that this will come up again in front of the whole committee.
Yeah,
and assuming that what I think is going to be the majority today prevails, I think we'll probably have some difficulty in the with some of the observations, comments that we get from the Hotel Motel Owners Association.
Brown, I have difficulty with this. I think we could head off some difficulty now. My only comment is, before we vote, I think we could head off some difficulty with this by doing a little more work on this subsection and saying what we mean, rather than letting it go under the broad term absconding. I don't think it says what we mean. With that, I'll just leave it right there. I think we're ready to vote on it. I can see we're ready to vote.
Let me ask one thing, make one request. Don, will you check 165.230 to see if the word abscond, as it's defined in sub D, is defined in the Supreme Court opinion under the annotations. All right, now all in favor then of adopting the language of sub 3 as it appears in preliminary draft 2, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
All right. Now, that completes. Now, we have next the alternative draft, which appears with the New York in the New York law, which is preliminary draft 2B, and I'm going to move to table that. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Alright. Now, would it be agreeable to the members or to all of us that we have Miller give us more of those sandwiches like we got the last time?
You bet.
Yeah, don't order one for me because I've got to leave pretty quick.
Okay.
Me too.
I think I'm retaining the services of another person. Take sandwiches.
Oh no.
Yeah, but no, I'm just saying that facetiously. But I do that.
We want you to stay with us as long.
The mere fact that you might leave would not necessarily be absconding.
Ed, we won't tell any of the utility companies about this. that brings up what we're going to get into now. Tampering, criminal tampering, preliminary draft 2.
Okay. Now, preliminary draft number 2. This conforms to the amendments that were adopted at the last subcommittee meeting. This is the language that was approved. And you'll note that there is no reference of any kind whatsoever to utilities in this draft. It has some new language that was adopted by the subcommittee. A person commits criminal tampering if he tampers or interferes with, that was inserted as a result of our last meeting, interferes with property of another with intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner or to another person and without having any right to do so or any reasonable ground to believe that he has such right. Now that eliminates and deletes language that appeared in sub, I think it was sub 2. Find my copy here. Of preliminary draft number 1.
Which was tampering means improper interference with something meddling within or making the law or not for alterations that. It's a existing condition, and then you went on to find the utility.
That's right. Yeah, all right. Either tampering or utility.
Now, did we suggest to you that you handle this in conjunction with the criminal mischief statute?
Yes, you did, and that appears, at least the suggested draft, appears as preliminary draft number 2A. Under criminal mischief.
Okay, well, let's defer our observations on tampering until you cover that.
All right, now 2A combines what amounts to tampering and also the intentional or malicious destruction of property. This is patterned after the New York Penal Law, sections 145 and 145.05. And there are copies of those on the blue sheets at the back of this section in your books. There are copies of the New York criminal mischief. There's a copy of the model penal code text on criminal mischief and also the Michigan draft. Now the Michigan draft, as with most of their provisions, is substantially the same as the New York approach. Now, Under my draft here of criminal mischief in the second degree is identical to preliminary draft number 2 on criminal tampering, which we just went through. A person commits criminal mischief in the second degree if he tampers or interferes with property of another with intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner or to another person without having a right to do so nor any reasonable ground to be believe that he has such right. Now that's the same, except we call it criminal mischief in the second degree rather than tampering. Then I go on to make criminal mischief in the first degree conduct which violates our first section there, and which further, as a result thereof, damages the property of another person, or with the intent to damage property, as opposed to the intent to cause substantial inconvenience, which appears in criminal mischief in the second degree, with intent to damage property, he damages, and without having any right to do so or any reasonable ground to believe that he has such right, he damages property of another person, making that alternative ways of committing criminal mischief in the first degree.
What's the derivation of first degree mischief for you?
Well, it's out of my head pretty much, although it's the language that without having a right or any reasonable ground to believe that he has such right, that language is from New York Penal Law 145.00. And of course, you can see that that the New York draft has 3 degrees of the crime. The Michigan draft has 3 degrees of the crime, first, second, and third. Criminal mischief in the first degree under the New York penal law makes it a more serious offense if he damages property in an amount exceeding $1,500 or by means of an explosive. And the Michigan draft also, their first degree is valued in an amount exceeding $1,000 or by means of an explosive.
With without getting into the some of the technical observations that we're having made with regard to these two degrees here, I'm wondering this. We presently have a statute in the book called Malicious Destruction of Personal Property, which is an indictable misdemeanor carrying not more than 3 years in the pen or a year in the county jail, and it includes, embraces the element of wantonness and maliciousness. Now, as I look here, this isn't covered, and I'm wondering if you gave any consideration at all to dividing criminal mischief into 3 degrees and having your present second degree, third degree, your present first degree, second degree, and include a first degree criminal mischief which would be comparable to our present
I think that this criminal mischief in the first degree encompasses 164-900, which is malicious or wanton, because it would require an intent to damage property without having any right or reasonable grounds to believe.
But
and also, wouldn't you, if you did that, you would, by implication, be saying that these 2 degrees did not require any intent, and somebody might say that's unconstitutional.
Well, isn't there a difference between intent and a malicious and wanton intent?
Well, now, wantonly, as used in our criminal code, ORS 161010, subsection 6, defines wantonly.
161010?
Sub 6. Wantonly, when applied to the commission of an act, implies that the act was done with the purpose to injure or destroy without cause and without reference to any particular person. Now, perhaps I haven't accomplished that, but that was the thought behind the language that appears in sub 2 of the draft on first degree mischief, that the person would need to have an intent to damage the property. Without any right or grounds to believe he had such a right. And that seems to me that that's pretty close to the definition of wantonly that appears in our statute now, that it was done with a purpose to injure or destroy without cause.
And in the second degree, it was done with a purpose to inconvenience.
Yeah, now, sub 1, I just tried to extend the criminal mischief that, or maybe the person, the actor, tampered with the property and he didn't intend to damage it, but his intent was to cause substantial inconvenience as a result of the tampering, but not necessarily, or maybe not at all, to damage the property. But he does, in fact, as a result of this intent to cause substantial interference, he does, in fact, damage the property.
He didn't mean to.
Well, I'm going to think out loud. You're embracing C second-degree mischief in first-degree mischief if there's damage.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now there's not.
If there's intentional damage.
No. It says he violates section. Commits.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And damage. So it's not malum in se as to the damage.
That's right.
Now is that, coach? In other words, Jane and I go out and get drunk and. We intend to tamper with something, and I do inconvenience the owner, and we don't have any intent of damaging it. She doesn't damage it in her act of tampering, but I do. I didn't intend to damage it, but by golly, here I am, subject to a possible felony. Of course, this is a thing under the felony murder. Same sort of thing that a felony murder is.
Sure. It would be. And assault to a first degree murder.
Yeah.
In either case, does the intent have to be towards a specific property, or can it be just generally against the property? And it turns out one piece of damage. You know, suppose you're out shooting the gun around, you don't care what you hit. Jones's house.
I think just the intent to shoot the gun.
The intent of. I think you could infer an intent to damage property if you're out shooting a gun.
I don't think you have to have specific intent as far as shooting, as far as hitting Jones's house in order to make it a crime of assuming he killed Jones.
You
didn't have a specific intent to kill him, it would be manslaughter, wouldn't it? Or
if you're standing up on an overpass above the freeway and as the cars are going below, you're throwing rocks off the overpass. You may not intend to hit any single car down there, but you eventually hit one of them, break a windshield or something. That you would then intend to damage that specific automobile. But, you would certainly have had an intent to damage property by throwing the rocks off there at the cars in the first place. So I think you would need a specific intent directed towards a certain property.
First intent is to make the car swerve, and subsequently cause the car to crash and become damaged. So,
let me just raise a few. The devil's advocate raised a couple of points. Make an observation. I think it's better the way we join them together. rather than just have criminal tampering parked by itself. Now, that's my own personal thought. And, second point, we would intend by this chapter to do away with the existing Oregon sections that follow it on page 2, 3, and 4. Is that correct, Don?
Well, as I read through these existing statutes, I felt that most of these would be encompassed in this draft. Now, there's one section here, however, 164.830, which deals with a person who purposely and maliciously, with intent to injure the person or property of another, sets off or explodes, or attempts to set off or explode any bomb, dynamite, powder, or other explosives. This, I think that should be picked up someplace else in the revision. And I certainly wouldn't be covered in this draft. These other types of...
In the section related to firearms or...
these others talk about breaking down monuments and I think you're going to need to we are going to need to spend considerable study on them to see whether or not there are elements in there that won't be covered. But as you read these statutes, you can see that they're intended not just to get at the destruction of the property, but they're intended to protect certain types of, well, certain types of property. That it's not because of the damage to the property that it's criminal, but because of the results of this damage. For example, destroying a monument, or boundary markers, and that type of thing. I think the destruction of this would be covered by this draft, but whether or not it would be covered to the extent it is now. In other words, when we get to the grading of these offenses and the type of punishment that is going to be inflicted or available for someone convicted of these crimes, whether or not we would afford the same amount of protection as exists in some of these existing statutes. I think for the most part we would, because these are all misdemeanors, I believe, except for
860, that's an indictable misdemeanor.
Yeah, that's an indictable misdemeanor, and 830 is an indictable misdemeanor.
No, I'm sorry, 860 isn't.
No, it's 890, isn't it?
Well, yeah. 850.
They're
not mean
as 900, excuse me. 164, 900 is an indictable misdemeanor.
But of course, the interfering with a monument or a benchmark or those sort of things, that would certainly be covered by tampering in the second degree, interfering with the property of another with intent to cause substantial inconvenience. Now,
164.850 prohibits a person from, any person who breaks or robs in any manner, or attempts to break or rob any flume, rocker, quartz mill, load, bedrock, sluice, etc., or trespasses upon such mining claim with the intent to commit a felony. Well, when we get to our criminal trespass, that's going to be that type of conduct will be picked up as trespass.
Let me ask this. We have some of these with regard to defacing posters, like 840 is an example. I think this probably was enacted originally for people that were tearing down posted notices for elections and things like that. But I'm wondering if we could have set some wording in our proposed statute, including defacing as well as damaging, making it a little bit broader. You see, some of these statutes that we have done presently talk about destroy or injure, or in fact, very nearly every one of them uses the words destroys and injures. We're going to damage it. I suppose probably defacing is embraced with damage. Do you agree, Jane? You think damaging is broad enough to cover
that? I'd have to look that up.
Damage would mean reducing its value, wouldn't it? Defacing would probably reduce its value.
Probably.
Yes, I'd say that's
yeah.
The advisor.
Yeah.
With a little washing, it may be restored its value very easily.
But it might have caused some mischief. It said something different than it was supposed to say.
Damn, yeah, it would, you'd interfere with, certainly. And
damage is the verb that's used by the Model Penal Code in their criminal mischief section. Damage is tangible property of another. Michigan uses damages property. New York uses damages property. I certainly think damage is preferable to destruction.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think so. Absolutely.
And I'm not so sure about injures.
Do we embrace the statute here on trees?
Well, there's a trespass statute that covers destruction of crops and that type of thing under our criminal under our present criminal trespass sections that we'll get to. And one of those does deal with trees.
Let me ask one other question, real quickly. In sub 2 of this criminal mischief in the first degree, wouldn't that be in the second line, nor any reasonable ground? Wouldn't that more properly be, or any reasonable ground? I'm suggesting that the word nor should be or.
Yeah, you know, the first time I drew this, I had and having no right. And then I went back and changed having no right to without having any right because it was consistent with the language that we had in our theft of services.
What do you think the anagraph of criminal mischief in the second and first degree as proposed?
Justice Sloan has been awfully quiet down there.
What I was trying to compare was the these that you were saying would eliminate. And I was just wondering how, for instance, you mentioned the trespass of trees, this kind of thing. If you couldn't include that within this, if when you published this with your commentary and intent, and specifically state these sections are intended to repeal or take the place of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you include, for instance, and trees, that kind of thing. If this wouldn't cover that just as well as having a separate trespass statute.
How about that, Don? I haven't frankly read your one on the trees.
Well, yeah, I don't think he has one, but I...
This is one of your trespasses.
Yeah, under one of the statutes that I refer to, my commentary to the trespass draft is 164.430, entering improved land of another with intent to injure growing products. There are some other timber trespass statutes that don't appear in our present criminal code.
It's 430. Entering improved land of another.
Yeah.
With intent to injure growing products.
And then it goes on to say, with intent to cut, take, carry away, destroy, or injure the trees, grain, grass, hay, fruit, or vegetable products growing on the land. And that type of conduct would be covered as trespass without proving an intent to cut the trees, when we get to the trespass draft. And if you'll see the provisions, the penalty provisions under some of these trespass statutes we have now, it's hard to see why they bothered to make it a separate offense, because the penalties there's not that much difference in these.
I'm going to suggest to you that we reserve judgment on Justice Sloan's suggestion until we have got into the trespass section, because it's hard for me to put it in perspective. And moving very quickly, because I want to take a couple minute recess, do you have any objections to criminal mischief as to $25?
Well, it's criminal mischief in the first degree, and the second way to do it, does that require proof of violation of section 1 of criminal mischief in the second degree if he violates section 1 with intent to damage the property? Is that what that means?
No.
He's guilty of first degree if with intent to damage property, and without any right to do it, he does damage property.
What sub 1 is, what I'm trying to say there is that if he tampers or interferes with property and has an intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner, and as a result of that, he damages the property of another person,
That's
a more severe offense.
And that's sub 1, but I'm talking about sub 2.
Yeah. Oh, excuse me, okay.
Does sub 2 require the violation of the first section of the thing? As well as with intent to damage property?
No.
So, isn't sub 2 a different kind of a crime? That's damaging property intentionally. There's no right to do it.
Well, that's what it says, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what it says, and I'm wondering if it belongs with criminal mischief.
Well, as a matter of fact, probably it belongs with criminal mischief more than the other one does. But what I was attempting to do was see if we could put these both together, as we discussed earlier, this tampering and criminal mischief.
Well, maybe what you're saying in essence is, shouldn't this be divided into 3 degrees? And sub 1 would be 1 second degree, and sub 2 would be...
When I first read this, the thought that I got was an erroneous thought, but it was that first one, second degree, if he tampers with property and causes inconvenience but no damage, that's second degree. And it's first degree if he tampers with it and damage results unintentionally. And it's also first degree, but more serious, if he tampers with it and intends to damage it and does damage it.
Problematical whether it's more serious, because by bunching the two both into the same degree, conceivably they're going to have the same range of penalty.
Yeah.
And the initial question that I raised at the outset of this discussion was, wouldn't the intentional damage be a more serious offense?
Number 1, he's guilty if he just accidentally damages it. Of the same offense?
I think so. Let's take a break.
Yeah. Are running into any problem about getting out your complaint or anything like that in that area? We had a seemingly mix between the two statutes.
And you're not running into a Berkey problem, are you?
Bruce and I feel that the problem that he raised could be very simply obviated by making sub 2 first degree mischief another degree. That would be first degree. Sub 1 would be second degree, and present second degree would be third degree. Now, Don, do you have any... Well, I registered the thoughts in opposition to that.
Well, no, not really in opposition, except that I think that if we want to do that, then we ought to take a closer look at
these other states and to see if you want to get into these. We're going to make it first, we're going to have first, second, and third. And you might want to reserve first degree for. See, the problem is with some of these degrees that these other states have, they've graded them
monetarily,
like they have some of these theft provisions. And we get into the same problem we've had up to now with some of these other sections about grading them before any decision by the commission on grading. And also the needs of an explosive see if you look at this one section now we have in ORS that I cited earlier to you, which I think the maximum penalty on that's 20 years.
Which one's that?
Damaging property with explosives.
That's 20 years. Didn't you suggest that we were going to pick that up someplace else?
Well, yeah, I think it should be picked up. We could pick it up in this section if. That it's first degree if you do this type of damage with by means of an explosive and stay away from any monetary grading if you want to do something like that.
Well, the point that we were concerned about was that damage to another's property without intent to damage it, but simply out of intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner and then it was damaged, that is of a lesser degree than is damage by virtue of intent to damage it, and that there shouldn't be within the same classification to have the same range of penalties.
Well, of course, some of that would be just as in our present statutes where you have a broad range of penalties, that's going to be handled by the judge, isn't it? Time of sentencing. In other words, an individual who's convicted of criminal mischief in the first degree and the evidence showed that he had an intent to interfere with his property or tamper with it, he wanted to cause some substantial inconvenience. That type of conduct, even though it's characterized as criminal mischief in the first degree, the same as intentional damage, as far as the individual is concerned, is he going to be protected at the time of sentencing under the penalty provisions? In other words, the judge is going to presumably continue to have some discretion the type of sentence that he imposes. And I tell you one other reason I kept this to 2 degrees and I've tried to keep these other proposed drafts to 2 degrees is because we're kind of shooting in the dark to a certain extent, and I may be anticipating something that's unjustified. Keeping in mind the observation of Saul Rubin, for example, when he appeared before the commission, one of his objections to the Michigan draft was that they have too many grades and too many degrees of crime. And it seemed to me that it would be a good idea to try to limit, as we go along here with these individual sections, try to limit the number of degrees, certainly until such times we see what the grading provisions are going to be for the entire code.
I didn't stay till you finished talking about whether there was any problem in drawing a complaint under.
I don't think there is, Ed.
There isn't?
I don't think there is. Maybe there isn't any problem either in including these within the same range of penalties.
Well, I think maybe it wouldn't need them in paragraph 2 then. He's guilty of the same sanction if he damages the property after tinkering with it or while tinkering with it. And the judge can give him a more serious sentence if the judge finds he did it on purpose. But he's guilty without the intent.
Well, I'll tell you, the reason I made that separate, though, it seemed to me that you might not be covering the type of conduct where it's just really malicious, wanton destruction of somebody's property, because it's hard to see where the individual throwing a beer bottle out of a car, a passing car, or up on the overpass throwing rocks down on the freeway. You could hardly call that tampering, or I mean, it might be interfering with the property of another. But what I was trying to do was get at both of them. The guy that just sets out to damage somebody's property and he does it. And also the individual who maybe didn't intend to damage anybody's property, but his conduct resulted in that nonetheless.
Well, maybe what you're saying is that this is two different subjects. It isn't tampering.
Well, there is difference. There's a substantive difference, really, between tampering, which we have here as second degree mischief, and
intentional damage of property.
Right, but I think there's probably a good statutory reason for putting them together. Like, what was the question?
Create any problems on drawing a plate or anything. There are no technical problems. It looks all right. I don't see as much of an electricity as it is.
Well, in your complaint, the charge of a person with the crime of criminal tampering by their being with the intent to damage the property without having any right to damage it. You did damage the property.
Yeah, you charged him criminal mischief.
Criminal tampering.
Of course, the substantive difference between second degree and first degree is the damage that is inflicted upon the property.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, though, that criminal mischief in the second degree should be about third degree, and criminal mischief in the first degree should be about second degree.
And then have one on the explosives?
It seems
or intentional damage?
Yeah. Because the one that we now have second degree is really not a very darn serious thing. And yet we've got it labeled second degree, which is, I think if we go to as someone was discussing here, if we go to a section in the whole revision that will establish first, second, third degree, we anticipate the first degree is going to be a pretty serious offense. Second degree is going to be medium, and the third is going to be very mild.
I think we anticipate that third degree would be a misdemeanor, second would be an indictable misdemeanor, and first would be a felony.
Yeah, that's why this might be out of order here, I think.
Intensity
might not be right.
I don't think the fact that you call something a first degree crime is necessarily going to require that it be treated as a felony.
Don, have you made a judgment as to where in our proposed future consideration you're going to stick this business of explosives in?
Well, I think a logical place where it could be put in would be under arson, perhaps.
More logical, you think? What about the situation that occurred when I was a kid where the boys broke into the county machine shed and stole a bunch of dynamite and took it out and blew up a bridge on a county road? That more properly comes under mischief, doesn't it? Rather than arson. Mm-hmm. It certainly should be mischief in the first degree, huh? So, without spending any more time on this, because I think that we're all in agreement with this as you prepared it, but I suggest that give some consideration to where you're going to, where you think this business of explosives or bombs should go.
Yeah.
And possibly come in with a revised draft, having that in the first degree here. Leave it, if it's acceptable with the others, leave it at that and grant John some flexibility and go on now.
The main thing I was trying to accomplish in this 2A was to see if we could fit these two things together.
Looks like that's been accomplished.
Malicious destruction type conduct along with the tampering.
The only change we have here in my order is the deletion of the nor and the insertion of or. And,
it has to be or with.
And without having any right to do so or any reasonable ground to believe.
In both sections.
No. Yeah, in both sections.
Cool.
Right. Alright. Let's flip on.
Now we have to really flip back, I think, in our books, don't we?
Well, we're going back to Berkeley, aren't we?
Yeah, so we have to go back in our books, too.
Behind.
Yeah. We've got Berkeley.
Not in this book.
Not in the one that we want.
Oh, alright. Okay. Okay. Have you all had a chance to read over these burglary provisions? Alright, well, we start off, of course, with a section on definitions. Now, these definitions are intended to be used in burglary and the criminal trespass provisions both. Now, some of them would not be used in trespass, but some of them would. All right, building, sub 1. In addition to its ordinary meaning, includes any vehicle, boat, aircraft, or other structure adapted for overnight accommodation of persons or for carrying on business therein. When a building consists of separate units, including but not limited to separate apartments, offices, or rented rooms, each unit is, in addition to being a part of such building, a separate building. Now, if you'll skip down to commentary, this definition of building is taken from the Connecticut Penal Code Bostrand. Its purpose is to include those structures and vehicles which typically contain human beings for extended periods of time, in accordance with the original and basic rationale of the crime, which is protection against invasion of the premises likely to terrorize occupants. And then sub 2 defines premises, includes the term building and any real property. Now this definition comes from the New York Revised Penal Law, section 140.100. The term is used in the substantive statement of the crime of criminal trespass. By incorporating the term building, the definition of premises thereby covers not only the ordinary concept of trespass to land, but includes the structures which would not be real property as well. This should make for more flexibility in applying. Now, when I say the structures, that means some of the structures that might not be real property, for example, a trailer house, something like that. This should make for more flexibility in applying the criminal trespass statutes to fit the facts of each particular case. And as we get to the trespass section, you can see that criminal trespass in the second degree would be a lesser included offense in the first degree. Subsection 3, dwelling, means a building which is usually occupied by a person other than the actor, lodging therein at night, whether or not a person is actually present. This definition is based on the New York proposal, section 140.00, and is similar to the definition of dwelling house that is set forth in ORS 164.210. Now, in your book, we set out the provisions of the burglary statute, and 164.210 defines dwelling house, includes any building of which any part has usually been occupied by any person lodging therein at night, and any structure joined to and immediately connected with such building.
And it doesn't have any other than the actor.
Now, I put that in with a certain amount of trepidation, because, as my commentary says here, I've inserted that because to preclude the possible incongruous result of a person who enters his own home with intent to commit a crime there and being charged with burglary.
You don't have any precedent for that, though. I checked the other draft under Connecticut, Michigan, Farm Penal Code, and they omit that. You commit a crime against yourself.
You can enter to murder your wife.
Well, there was I cite a Willamette Law Review article in here, in my commentary, yes, in which this possibility was raised.
But not commonly.
That, for example, an individual who enters his own home, where he dwells, with the intent to commit statutory rape upon the babysitter, under our statute, could be charged with burglary.
Well, now how so? Because there's no breaking, is there? Or entering? Under our statute, burglary is the breaking and entering. Look at 164.010, which defines